Okay, well, we are in Luke 20, and we covered down through verse 18 last week. I'm going to apologize up front. This has been a hectic, distracted day, and I didn't get as much study time on this as I wanted to, and it's pretty heavy-duty stuff. So I don't want us to be superficial, but we'll see what comes out. Your help will be very much appreciated. Last week we covered Jesus' teaching. Oh, by the way, we're in the last week of Jesus' life. The triumphal entry took place. He's got a week to live, and he's amping up his agitation levels, more and more being in the face of, not nasty, just incisively. And the religious leaders are not liking it. They ask, for example, in the first eight verses, why are who gave you authority to be teaching these things? Where'd it come from? And you remember what his answer was? If you can tell me whether the baptism of John is from heaven or from men, then I'll talk to you. And they started waffling, didn't they? Well, if we say from heaven, then he'll say, well, why didn't you do it? But if we say from men, why weren't they willing to say it was from man? They feared the people. And that I didn't land on that point last week, but that's kind of interesting that the leaders feared the people. And well, we're leading, and you need to be afraid of the authority we wield, but we want to keep you as our followers, so we're afraid of what you're going to do to us if we go a little bit askew from your perceptions. So they were walking a tightrope, and any time that you're in it to please men, you're going to be walking that tightrope. If you're just in it to please God, it's not you're not going to worry about what people do. You're just going to do what needs to be done. So that was an interesting interchange. So since you can't tell me, I won't tell you. And then he started presenting to the people a parable that would expose the emptiness and the wickedness, really, of these men. Now, they were the shepherds of God's people. They were the stewards of God's house. They were the vineyard keeper of God's vineyard. We learn from Isaiah 5 that the house of Israel was God's vineyard. These were the vineyard keepers. And so this parable was about a vineyard and a vineyard keeper. And he put the owner of the vineyard, put the vineyard under the control of the vineyard keepers, then he himself departed to come back later and kept sending to get what was his. And every time he sent some servants to get what was his, the vineyard keepers would abuse or send away empty-handed, mistreat. So he said, I'm going to send my son. And they said, you know, if we kill the son, then the vineyard will be ours because the old man's going to die, you know, whatever the parable was. And so Jesus said, what will the owner of the vineyard do to those vineyard keepers? Well, he's going to uproot them. He's going to kick them out. He says, have you never read that the stone which was rejected, now in this parable, who was rejected? The son, right? The son was rejected. Have you never read that the stone which was rejected became the chief cornerstone anyway? And whoever tries to take that stone, whoever falls on that stone, is going to be obliterated. And whoever the stone falls on is going to be scattered like dust. And they understood that he was speaking the parable against them. And so, verse 9, that brings us down to verse 19. That's a little bit of connective review. Hi, guys. A little bit of connective review. And how do you suppose the scribes and the chief priests felt about that?
Well, the first sentence describes how they
Yeah,
feel.
the first sentence says, we would like to lay our hands on them. See how Rod translated that. The scribes and the chief priests were seeking to get their hands on him. Not just lay there, get their hand on him, grab him, arrest him, and do what with him?
Yellow.
Yeah, we want to deliver him. Yeah, they feared the people. They wanted to get their hands on him, but they're afraid of the people because they understood he spoke this parable about them. So, verse 20, it says, and they watched him. They watched him. Why were they watching him? What do you want? To see if they could catch him in something, right? Scott, I made a mistake. I forgot to turn the amplifier on to get the microphone. If anybody online says something, I want you all to be able to hear it. They were seeking an opportunity. They were wanting to catch him in something. They're wanting to be in the inner circle. So maybe in the inner circle, he'll say things that he's not willing to say publicly, right? So it says they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous. How do you pretend to be righteous? What's up? But I need to. It's a good thing to have the amplifier on. It'd be better if some kind of voice sent to the amplifier, right? Okay. Funny how that works. Okay, and so they how do you pretend to be righteous? What's going on with that? They pretended to be righteous.
They pretended to agree with the Jesus' souls.
They were chameleons. They blended in with the disciples. They looked like one of the disciples. They acted like they knew what to say and how to say it, right? What do you call that?
Acting.
Pardon?
Acting.
That's acting.
Hypocrite.
You know what the Greek word for play actor was? Hypocrite. Literally. That's what a hypocrite is, one who plays a part. So they're playing the part. How easy is it to look like a righteous person? You go to church on Sunday, you sit in the pew, you sing along, but it isn't, it's just a skin. It's kind of like the sausage skin without the sausage. Just an empty shell of a thing. But that's what they were doing, okay? And so there they were, hoping to catch him in a statement. Maybe he'll say something privately to his disciples that we haven't heard said publicly. And he goes, aha! What did Jesus say about that in a different place? Didn't he say whatever is said in the inner room will be broadcast openly? And so completely transparent, complete transparency of behavior and word. But why would they suppose that they could find, catch Jesus in something?
Takes one to know one.
Takes one to know one. Yeah, they thought he was just like them, one of their leaders trying to get a following, and so say whatever needs to be said, but in the private group, say what they really believe. But that's not what happened. They were going to try to seize upon something he said so that they could deliver him to the rule and authority of the governor. That's kind of interesting. Not the rule and authority of the chief priest, but of the governor. Now, the governor was, yeah, but he was Roman. That's where he goes. He was Roman, not Jewish. So we're going to try to get him in trouble with the big dog. Yeah. And so that's what's going on. So what was the ruse? You remember what the ruse was? It was a question. Should we pay taxes to Rome or not? Okay. What if Jesus said, Now, Jews, no Jew should ever pay tax to the Romans. Who were they trying to snatch him out against? The governor. Okay. He'd be in trouble with the governor. But it's just, yeah, we Jews ought to pay taxes to the Romans. Then who is he going to be? He'd be in trouble, especially with the Jewish leaders. See, they're trying to do to Jesus what Jesus had done to them. Remember in the first part of the chapter? He says, the baptism of John, where, heaven or man? See, you got to make a choice. They said, we don't know. By saying we don't know, they skewered themselves on the third horn of the trilemma. What are you being teachers if you don't know the answer? Right? Here, they're trying to do the same thing. Should we pay it to Caesar or not? If we say, yeah, okay, you're disloyal to God. If they say, no, you're disloyal to the ruling authorities. What did Jesus actually say? Give me a coin. Anybody got a coin? Anybody here got a quarter? Nobody got a quarter? Or penny or a nickel? Anybody got? You do. A pickle. A penny and a nickel combined is a pickle. No, just, well, okay, yeah. Give me a coin. Whose picture is on there? It's a quarter. Looks like George Washington. Okay, give to George. What belongs to George? Give to God what belongs to him. How easy is that? And I can picture Jesus just flipping the coin back to them and saying, you got your answer right there. It's like, what a stupid question. What a, just, whose picture is on there?
It is a stupid question, because you know what would have happened had they not, he said, don't do that.
Yeah. Well, don't pay your tax, or
yeah,
pay your tax. Either way, they got him. He says, give me the coin. Now, verse 23, it says, considering carefully, that's my translation, 23, but he detected their trickery, detected. Now, the word is deep thought, according to his thinking, katanoia, not paranoia, katanoia. Deep, he considered, he thought it through. You know, there are times that before you answer, you got to think a thing through. You got to go deep with it. And so Jesus is, oh, yeah, now wait a minute. Who are these guys? They're pretending to be my followers. And realize this, his followers would know the answer. Would, first of all, wouldn't have asked that kind of question.
Right.
No, because they're not trying to trap Jesus in anything. So he just kind of thought it through and said, whose picture's on that coin? Give it to him. Give your heart to God. And what belongs to God, give to God. What belongs to Caesar, give to Caesar. And they were unable to catch him in any say. Unable is, it is a fine translation, but it kind of loses a little bit of the power of it. It says they weren't strong enough to seize him in anything. They didn't have the mental strength, the mental capacity, the mental ability to catch Jesus out in anything. How does that make you feel? If people who are trying to trip Jesus up are totally unable to do so, that kind of elevates his ability to see through things. And if I'm following him, I'm in pretty good shape. I mean, that's my takeaway from it. So their takeaway from it is, we can't catch him anything in the presence of the people. Every time we try, what happens?
Cuts it down.
Yeah, but you're right. But how do the people feel about that?
We always have an answer.
Yeah, you're seeing the power. You're seeing a power shift.
Yeah. Yeah, you see them saying, every time we try to trap him, the people get excited because he traps us instead. And so we're not going to do it in the presence of the people. We're gonna take our subterfuge into private places, which is what they actually end up doing. So they became silent. Now, but they're not done. Got another trick question. Another trick question here, Candy. There came to him some of the Sadducees. What's a Sadducee?
Somebody doesn't believe in the resurrection.
Or angels or spirits. Yeah, we're learning that from what? Acts 23?
Three.
Yeah, Acts 23. Paul perceived that part of it was Sadducees and part of it was Pharisees. And so he says, I'm on trial for the resurrection and hope of Israel. And that got them fussing with each other. But the Sadducees were those that didn't believe in the resurrection. They say there is no resurrection. That's pretty lame. Pardon? They were in power. They were kind of the Democrats of the day. They really didn't believe in God, although they would mouth it. They believed more in humanism and things of that ilk. But they had control of the temple. That was their bailiwick, which is a sadness because Sadducee is probably a name is probably derived from Zadok, one of their earlier high priests. I think he was high priest in the time of David. Now, this word, say there is no resurrection, it's okay, but it's puny, it's weak. It's literally they speak against the resurrection. Literally, the Greek verb is speak against. They speak against the resurrection. It's not just they don't believe it, not just they say there isn't one. They speak against, kind of like some of these atheists who aren't just professing to be atheists. They're actually trying to shoot down belief in God. And so speaking against it, that's who Jesus is up against here. That's the level of animosity that he's facing here at this point. And they say there is no resurrection. Now, I need to pause here big time because it would be real easy just to be superficial about this. When you say resurrection, what are you talking about? Okay. Generally speaking, when you hear the word resurrection, you think somebody coming back up out of the graveyard, coming back to life out of the graveyard. Okay? The Bible almost never uses it that way. Almost never. If at all, the word means it is anastasis. Ana means again. Stasis means to stand, like static. It means to stand. To stand again. Well, who stands again? Somebody got knocked down. Okay, now, with this, I want to look at two passages from the Old Testament. This would be what the Sadducees would be denying. In Hosea chapter 5, the end of Hosea 5. You can read the first four chapters and see that God is dealing with a rebellious, wicked nation, his people. And he says, in verse, what verse? I'll just start in verse 14. There was something earlier in the chapter, I'm not finding it right off the top of my head. Where he says, I'm going to leave them. I'm going to depart from them. I'm going to abandon, not abandon. I'm just going to walk away from my people. But in verse 14, he says, I will be like a lion to Ephraim. Now, Ephraim was the chief tribe of the 10 northern tribes of Israel. It was where the capital city was. It was the ruling tribe. I will walk away from Ephraim. I will be like a young lion to the, or I will be a lion to the house, to Ephraim, and like a young lion to the house of Judah. Now, what he's got there is the 10 northern tribes, Ephraim, and the two southern tribes, Judah, all 12 tribes. He says, I'll be like a lion to them. I will tear to pieces and go away. I'm going to rip my people to pieces and I'm going to leave them. I will carry away. And there will be none to deliver. I will go away and return to my place until They acknowledge their guilt and seek my face. In their affliction, they will earnestly seek me. Now, forget the chapter break. Verse 1 is the words that the people would use when they're seeking him. Come, let us return to you, for he has torn us, but he will heal us. He has wounded us, but he will bandage us. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day, that we may live before him. So, what's going on when Hosea introduced the idea of a resurrection for Israel? People who had been ripped to shreds by God and left in captivity, but when they change their heart, then he will raise them back up. They will have standing again. The anastasis, standing again. They're standing again with God. What I'm saying is from Hosea, that's what Israel was expecting. That's what the Sadducees were saying couldn't. Nah, we're dead. They're gone. We're not going to have those people, Abraham, David, etc. They're not going to be part of what God's doing anymore. And our nation is not going to be raised up like that. Come over here to the book of Ezekiel.
Was it that they go ahead. Wouldn't be raised up, or was it that they wouldn't die out?
Well, they're denying, they're speaking against the resurrection. That and we'll see as we go into the text of Luke. He says, this is the mistaken part here. And we get this from the Matthew Mark accounts. That you don't know the scriptures. A, that's why we're looking at the scriptures. And B, you know the power of God. Can God raise somebody back up who has died 1,000 years ago? Yeah. If that's your God, if that's not your God, well, then he can't. And there's a reason the Pharisees, Sadducees were denying the resurrection. They didn't believe that. They didn't understand the scriptures. And they didn't believe that God could make that nation come back to life, make the people of that nation come back to life. In Ezekiel, you ever heard the song, Dim Bones, Dim Bones, Dim Dry Bones, from Ezekiel 37? Ezekiel 37, Ezekiel saw a picture of a valley of full of dried bones, scorched, dried bones. And God said to him in verse 3, Son of man, can these bones live? And Ezekiel said, you know, O Yahweh, you know, O Lord Yahweh, you know. He said, prophesy. And say to him, dry bones, hear the word of Yahweh. And so I will, look at verse 5. For thus says the Lord Yahweh to these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter you that you may come to life. Okay? He's preaching to bones, right? You say to these bones, I'm going to make you come back to life. And I'll put sinew on you and make flesh grow back on you and cover you with skin and put breath in you that you may come alive, and you that I am Yahweh. So I proclaimed as I was commanded. And as I prophesied, there was a noise, a rattling, and the bones came bone to bone, bone to bone, bone. And I looked, and behold, sinew was on them, and flesh grew, and skin covered them. But there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, prophesy, son of man, and say to the breath, thus says the Lord Yahweh, come from all winds, O breath, and breathe on these slain, that they may come to life. So I prophesied as he commanded, and the breath came into them, and they came to life and stood on their feet, so an exceedingly great army. So the picture is complete there, Alan. Dry, bleached bones that God brought back together, covered with, filled with sinew and organs, and put flesh on it, and then put breath in it, and they were alive. It looked like it was impossible. The Sadducees say that can't happen. They, well, what you saw in Ezekiel just can't happen. Well, keep reading. We're not done yet. Verse 11. Then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. The house of Israel that Ezekiel was preaching to were pictured as bones. They say our bones are dried up and our hope has perished. That's what the Sadducees were saying. We have no hope to come back to life as in we are completely cut off. Therefore prophesy and say, thus says the Lord Yahweh, behold, I will open your graves.
When the whole house of Israel at that time was in exile in Babylon.
That's why they thought they were dead. Yeah, they were in exile, off their land, separated from the land, dead to God. That, I mean, we saw that's how they saw themselves. And he says, I will open your graves. What graves? Not a literal grave, because these are still living people. He's preaching to living people who saw themselves as God.
Grave is the captivity in battle.
Yeah, the grave is figurative of what do you do with a dead person? Put them in a grave. That's where we are. We're off here in captivity. We're in prison. We're not alive to God anymore. He says, I'm going to open that up. And I cause you to come out of your graves, my people. I will put my spirit within you. When did God do that? I will put my spirit within you. And you will come to life and I will place you on your own. Then you will know that I, Yahweh, have done it. Spoken and done it. Declares Yahweh. Now, the rest of this chapter is really connected, and I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but if you come down to the next 5 or 6 verses talking about two sticks coming together into one stick, and so you got the 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes have been divided since the days of Solomon, but they would be restored as one. If you can raise them back to life, you can restore them as one, okay? And I will, verse 22, I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel, and one king will be king of all of them, and they will no longer be two nations, and they'll no longer be divided into two kingdoms. They will no longer defile themselves with their idols or go after with their detestable things or with any transgression, but I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned. I will cleanse them. They'll be my people. I'll be their God. But keep going. Verse 24. And my servant David will be king over them. That's Jesus pouring out of the Spirit into the people of God. That's the day of Pentecost. The resurrection of Israel was accumulated, or was accomplished by these things. Pouring the Spirit into God's people, giving them a king, bringing them to a new covenant. As you keep reading here, they'll live on the land Jake and that I gave Jake. David, my servant, will be prince over them forever, six, and I will make a covenant of peace with them. So if we connect all these things together, and I know this is a new thought for most people, but you can connect all these things together. The raising up, if you can dismiss from your mind the idea of coming out of a grave after you physically died, if you can put it in your mind that God wanted people who were spiritually dead to him to come back to life, be restored to him, stand before him, not fallen down, but stand before him, have a King David and a new covenant. See, if you put all that together, that's what the prophets were presenting to Israel. Come the time when Messiah comes, I'll raise you back up to myself. Now, the Pharisees or the Sadducees misunderstood what resurrection was, and that's why they put this silly little thing together. But before we go on, I've got to pause here, and I don't want to lose anybody. You have any questions about the concept of when the Sadducees speak against the resurrection? What Rod thinks they were speaking against. You have any questions about that? Now, this is not a question in my mind of whether or not we're going to come up out of a physical grave. Yeah. To me, it's a non-starter, because I'm going to heaven to be with God, and I'm not in a physical body. And so, but if I'm dead to God, I want to stand to God again. Do what? To what? To what did Paul compare baptism in Romans 6? Pardon?
Death and resurrection.
The death, the burial, and the resurrection. And especially he was talking to them about, should we continue in sin that grace might increase? No, you were raised to walk a new life. And just like Jesus would never die again, neither will you. But he wasn't talking about physical death. He was talking about that death to God. Genuinely died to yourself. You were buried with Jesus in baptism, and you rose up out of that water to walk a new life. That's what resurrection is. That's what resurrection is, coming back to life to God. All right. Now, not everybody agrees with me on that, and that's all right. I've presented my case. Maybe it'll hold up, maybe it won't, but it's only something for you to think about. But back here in Luke 20, they spoke against the idea of resurrection. They didn't just dismiss it, they spoke against it. So they questioned him. They've got this thing. See, Deuteronomy 25, verse 5 and following verses, Moses said, if a man has a wife and he dies before there's any children, his brother is to go and take that woman as his wife, and the first child will be his brother's child. That's the Levirate marriage law, Deuteronomy 25, 5. So Moses wrote us that if a man's brother dies having a wife and he is childless, his brother should take the wife and raise up offspring to his brother. Now, here's the problem. We have a case. I don't know that they really had this case. It might be a manufactured case, a hypothetical. For hypothetical purposes, let's talk about this case. Okay? So, this man married that woman. He died, no children. So his brother, according to Deuteronomy 25:5, took her. He died, no children. Bang, 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 and bang. Seven of them. They all died, no children. And then that poor worn-out woman, she died too. All right, there's the scenario. Okay, here's the problem. In the resurrection, whose wife will she be? Now, was it possible for one man to have several wives? David did. Abraham did. Isaac, now Jacob did. Solomon had a few, didn't he? 300 wives and 700 concubines. Had a few. Who ever heard of one woman having two husbands or three or four? We got a dilemma here, Jesus. We got a real problem. We got a real mess. Who's she going to be in the resurrection? Now, here's the thing. Using a hypothetical to deny scripture. How do you feel about that? Here's a passage. Maybe I don't like it. Maybe I don't understand it. Maybe it conflicts with something I believe. I want to get rid of it. So I pose a hypothetical situation that nobody I've ever experienced can answer. Therefore, thing I don't like must not be true. Now, that's basically what the Sadducees are doing. And probably getting away with it with the Pharisees, who believe in the resurrection, but probably can't answer this. So, well, try this one out on Jesus, and he can do with it. What did he do with it? Let's see. Hi, Bob. Bev, we are in chapter 20 at verse 32. Finally, the woman died also. You're welcome. In the resurrection, therefore, which man's wife will the woman be? They all had her as wife. Jesus said to them, now I love what he said over in Mark. He says, isn't this the reason you're mistaken? Isn't this why you're mistaken? Obviously you're mistaken, and here's why. And he gave two reasons. And you can find this in Mark 12 at verse 24. It's similar, but not quite as powerful in Matthew 22, verse 28. Jesus said, the reason you're mistaken is, number one, you don't know the scriptures. So we just spent a little bit of time in the two most fundamental passages that talk about resurrection in the Old Testament, Hosea 6, and which, by the way, I didn't mention this, but I will now. The Hosea 6 passage is referred to, alluded to by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 when he talked about the resurrection, raised up on the third day. And then Ezekiel 37, the whole chapter dealing with the resurrection, the restoration of Israel back into a standing with God under the new Messiah with a new covenant. Yeah. Says you don't know the scriptures. Secondly, you don't know the power of God. So Jesus said in verse 34, the sons of this age marry and are given an age. Now, what does he mean, the sons of this age marry? Is he talking about you, Alan? Are you a son of that age? No. What age? The age in which the Levirate law pertained, the age of Moses, the Mosaic covenant age. Why was that law there? What was the purpose of that law? Protect property, to ensure propagation, to continue the line. He says, the sons of this, that's why they marry and given marriage, that they've got to keep replenishing the nation, the citizenry, under Moses. He says, but sons of this age, marry and are given in marriage those who are considered worthy to attain to that age. What age? To that age. You see that in there in verse 35? To attain to that age. What age?
They should come.
They come, but that age references something said, right?
Yeah.
The age of the resurrection. That's what's under consideration. That's what's being resisted and spoken against. The sons of the age of the resurrection, they don't marry. What do you mean they don't marry? Are you a son of the age of the resurrection? Of course you are now. And you got married. I know you got married. I see your daughter sitting right there. I got married. What's he getting at? Sons of this age don't. Is he talking about what it's going to be like up in heaven? Is that what he's talking about? That's where most people put it.
That is no longer needed.
That's not how the new covenant population is continued. The old covenant population was continued and carried on through the Levirate marriage for the brother who failed to have a son before he died. But that's not how the new covenant population is generated. How's the new covenant population, how is it attained to or sustained or generated, whatever word you want to use? What did Paul, let me call, say it this way, what did Paul call Timothy?
Son.
My son. But he had a father who was a Greek and a mother who was a Jewess in another city, but he called him my son. Why? Was Timothy Paul's son? Because he led him to Christ. He brought him to the new birth. So the new covenant people are not sustained the way the old covenant people were as far as continuing the population. He said it's kind of like, I was going to say that was then, this is now. But it's kind of like the old wineskins and the new wineskin thing. You don't put new wine in old wineskins. You don't take this idea from the old and try to merge it onto the new. It just doesn't work that way. So let me get back to our text here again. But those who are considered worthy to attain to that age, the age of the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage, for neither can they die anymore. Why did the second son, second brother, take that woman? Because the first brother died. And so, Don't take the elements of this story and generalize them away from the story. We're talking about one who died, and he died, and he died, and he died, and she married all of them along the way. Well, that's not the case in the propagation of the kingdom, of the resurrection age. Okay? He says, let me go ahead.
That is a kingdom, but that's the same thing.
It is. But it's a different terminology, different picture. Being sons of God, they are sons of God being sons of the resurrection. Now, to me, that just clinches it. That we're not talking about coming, popping up out of the grave down at the end of earth time, if there is such a thing. But we're talking about being raised back up to God to be a son of God. Are you a son of God? How'd you become a son of God? You were raised back up to stand. Again, I'm trying to divorce our minds from the idea that we're talking about bodies coming out of tombs. We're talking about people who were dead coming back to life to God. What do you fear more, spiritual death or physical death? Why? Why isn't physical death scary? I mean, it's scary because we're going to lose our life, but it's not to be feared.
Is it temporary?
Yeah. If I'm alive to God when I die in my body, I just go home. I'm freed from everything that can tempt me and trap me and entice me. I'm freed from all that. I'm going home because I'm also freed from the love of my wife, the love of my children, my grandchildren, my friends. I'm freed from that, but only temporarily. Okay? And so he says, they're sons of God being sons of the resurrection. All right, so that's the picture. He says, I want you to understand that coming to that age is coming back to life to God. He's talking to the Pharisees, the Sadducees, remember, talking to the Sadducees. Important to keep that point in mind. But that the dead are raised, this is the thing that the Sadducees were just choking over, that the dead have raised, even Moses showed in the bush. What do you mean? This is Exodus 3, by the way. What do you mean Moses showed this in the bush? I did.
Yeah. 36.
I know, I talked about that. Being they are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. Oh, you want me to talk about like the
But
angels?
I think you they cannot this is the, I think that first verse or first line of the where they can't even die anymore, kind of it really puts the stamp on what you're saying.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Because of course we can die physically, but he's not this proves he's not talking physical. This is spiritual.
If he's talking physical, the latter part of the verse says, you have to wait until you raise out of the grave to be a son of God.
Right.
I'm a son of God now. How did I get to be a son of God now? By being raised back to life to God, spiritually, not physically. The problem is identifying these things as a physical process, and that's the problem the Sadducees had who didn't believe in angels or spirits either. But in verse 20 or 37, are the dead raised? What about the bush proves that the dead aren't dead? Now you think that the dead are dead. But what did God say to Moses in the bush? I am, not I was, not I will be. I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. That's what he said to Moses. Now, God is a God of the living, not of the dead, which if he said, I am the God of men who have passed away from this earth, they're still alive. They're still alive. And if they're still alive, they can still be part of God's plan. Now, that's a level that I didn't want to get, I don't want to get into. The idea of Walking with God in this life is a time limited thing, but being alive to God is not. Okay. Now, if there's no resurrection, then Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are gone. That's it. No possibility for them with God. But if God, think about it, Rachel, if God so wanted you to be with him after you spent your life on this earth, that he would send his son Jesus to die for you, that means that life on this earth, as short as it is, he was investing in. He was investing in eternity with you. Okay. So when does that start? After you die? Or after you die to yourself? After you die to yourself, are buried in baptism and raised up to newness of life, Romans 6. Go ahead.
I think it's kind of amazing. Jesus didn't talk about the afterlife.
No.
And here's one of the few times he does, and it's to refute the people that know, think they know what's going on.
Yeah.
Not to the average person. He didn't talk about the afterlife.
You know, he really didn't. He talked about the present life.
Right.
John 10:10, I came that they might have life, have it abundantly right now. He didn't talk about much. There's not much in the Bible about what it's going to be after we die. David did say when his son died, his infant son, he can't come to me, but I will go to him. Now, I don't know if he just meant I'll see him in the grave. I doubt it. I think he had more. Abraham envisioned a city where he would be with God. And so I believe that the Old Testament worthies had a vision of life after life. But the Bible doesn't emphasize that. It emphasizes life with God. And we live life with God now. If we don't live life with God now well, that won't be. We won't want a life with God afterward. So, okay. So he said, Moses in the bush called. He said, I'm the God of Isaac and Jacob. Now, he's not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. Guy's still alive, is the point Jesus made. Now, if those guys are still alive, then it's not once you're dead all over, just like a little puppy Rover. You're still alive to God. And some of the scribes, now these scribes are not Pharisees, the scribes would perhaps be adversaries to the Sadducees at times, you know, the other side of the argument. Mm-hmm. And they said, you've answered well. It's like, wow, now we have an answer to the argument that we couldn't answer before. And I love that about Jesus. It bails us out with our answers to arguments that puzzle us. And some of the scribes answered and said, teacher, you've spoken well, for they did not have courage to question him any longer about anything. Okay, I'm not going to talk anymore. But Jesus wasn't done. And he said to them, I want to remind you that both Mark and Matthew insert that statement by Jesus. The reason you are mistaken is twofold. You don't know the scriptures and you underestimate the power. I'd put, as my mom used to say, put that in your pipe and smoke it. You know the scriptures, and you don't know the power. Underestimate or don't know the power of God, that's why you're mistaken. So, what do you do to get unmistaken? You reverse those two. You know the scriptures, and as you know the scriptures, you'll see the power of God. You'll see what he's done and can do. Done and will do, and you'll cease to be mistaken. But Jesus is not done, and we've got 9 minutes to finish being done. And he said to them, how is it that they are, what is it that, how is it that they say of the Christ David's son? How can they say that? Now, we take it for granted Christ is David's son, but Rachel, do you see the problem in saying that? That Christ is David's son?
Not from God. I mean that Mary's.
No, okay, you're going down the wrong path. But
Oh.
that's all right. That's all right. You have to think like a Middle Easterner about the dynasty, the lineage, the lineage, the lineage.
The lineage.
Yes, the lineage. The
Oh.
son of the king could never be the king's master. He could never be the king's lord because he was the son. So who is the Christ? He's the son of David. But who is the Christ? David calls him Lord. How can David call his own son Lord? See, what's the word I'm looking for? The enigma that they have, how do you sort this thing out? That the king, die something or another. David himself says in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, said at your right hand, till make the enemies a footstool of your feet. If David calls him Lord, how is he his son? But Jesus didn't answer the question. He posed the question. And it's a question that you have to figure out. How is it possible that the Messiah, David's son, would also be David's Lord? See, now they had trouble with the concept of people dead to God coming back to life because they left it in the physical realm, right? So how is it that David's son is David's Lord? Especially if the son didn't come until after David was dead. But you can't leave it in the physical realm like this. That was what their problem was. Genealogy of Jesus in Matthew as his lineage, a guy got by the name of David, the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, verse 1. How is he his son? How is he his Lord? It's clear he's his son. 42 generations later, according to Matthew, from Abraham to Jesus, 42 generations from David to Jesus, 28 generations. That's a long way to go to have him be your Lord. Any thoughts on how is it possible for this guy who's born so many years later to be this guy's Lord? Did David make a mistake in the Psalms calling him his Lord? No, David's.
Generations don't matter because it's all just physical. I mean, it's all just spiritual. All the physical is gone. Most of all.
Okay.
Go back to the bush.
Well, no, Jesse Jackson said, get out of the bushes. Okay.
The God of the living, for one thing,
God of the living.
the
Okay.
thing that is not dead.
Not dead.
And then we know who Messiah is because he has been prophesied to be the son of the Holy One.
Yeah, in Isaiah 9, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, but
Son of
ever
God.
to us a son will be given, and his name will be called
Sir, mighty God, everlasting Father.
Everlasting Father. So the son of David, go to chapter 11 of Isaiah, the root of Jesse, that David's father, would bring forth this child. This child in chapter 6, in chapter 7, he's virgin born. Okay. In chapter 6 or 9, chapter 9, he's called Everlasting Father. My Everlasting Father. So, if you knew your scripture, why are you mistaken? Because you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. If you knew the scriptures, you'd understand that Messiah was the offspring of God, as well as the offspring of David. How does a virgin give birth? We know from early in Luke, because the Holy Spirit came upon her, and that which is in was of God. But Jesus is not going through all those hoops. He's just saying, you can read it in the text, that David calls him Lord. You have to work out a conclusion on that. The only way that his son could be his Lord is if he was more than human, if he was in fact divine. It's the only way it could happen. The only thing that could answer the situation. And Jesus expected them to do the mental gymnastics to get to that conclusion. So he didn't just throw it out. He said, how? Whose son is he? David's. Then how does David call him Lord? In the spirit. I hadn't thought of that. Well, that's the problem. You don't know this. Okay? It's one thing to know, like, I've got a memory verse. My favorite memory verse from John 11:35. Jesus wept. Man, I got that one nailed. Okay. I've remembered that ever since I was a kid. Okay. What does it mean? Oh, and now you're taking it to a different level. It's not just knowing what the words say, knowing what the words, the message that the words are conveying. You don't know the scriptures. That's why you're mistaken. Anyway, I love it that Jesus and expected them to be able to draw that conclusion. He didn't feed them the conclusion. He expected them to draw that conclusion. He expected them to realize, I don't know the answer to that. Well, why are you a spiritual leader if you don't know the answer to that? That's a fairly important question, don't you think?
You missed the same question.
Yeah. Anyway, that's enough for tonight, unless you got questions.